Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Victories for the Democrats and BP this week, and an economy still in trouble. Financial reform cleared Congress and heads for the president's desk. The president hailed it as a game changer for the American people.
Reform that will prevent the kind of shadowy deals that led to this crisis. Reform that would never again put taxpayers on the hook for Wall Street's mistakes.
In the Gulf, a cap is on the oil. BP's chief operating officer, Doug Suttles, is optimistic, but says the work is not yet done.
We have to actually go in with the relief well and seal this well off so it can no longer flow. So that activity will continue until this well no longer has the capability to ever flow again.
Tough poll numbers out for the president. Walter Powell of California knows what people need.
A job, period. A job, you know? Most people, they can't get jobs.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Are you celebrating the capped oil? Still on edge? Has Congress fixed Wall Street? What's your top story this week? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got perspective today from right across the country. With us from St. Louis is Joe Manis, political reporter for the St. Louis Beacon. Joe, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And from Portland, Oregon, we're joined by Jeff Mapes, senior political reporter for the Oregonian newspaper. Jeff, great to have you here.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Joe, and Jeff.
Let's get some nationwide perspective right here, right off the bat, on what we're seeing in the Gulf. Jeff, just give us your first reaction to this. That video that we've watched hideously gushing for 86, 87 days, not gushing now. How's it make you feel?
An incredible sense of relief. You know, I think, you know, Americans particularly, we're pretty darn impatient people, and to have to go through this for so many months, I think, is just agonizing to people. And, you know, it's interesting. You might think, since we're way up in a northwest corner of the country, that this all seems very remote to us. But remember, Oregon is a coastal state, and we've gone over, you know, through some of our own battles over offshore drilling. So I think this very much resonates with folks out here.
Joe Manis, you're right there on the Mississippi. You're connected by water to the story in the Gulf. Everybody is making it very clear that this is not necessarily over. In fact, the oil could start gushing again if they're worried that there are leaks elsewhere in the system. I mean, how big a high five can we give at this point, Joe?
Well, I think everyone is very cautious, very cautiously optimistic. The next few days are probably going to be crucial. I mean, here in Missouri, we're landlocked. Although we are on the Mississippi, we do have some traditional cultural ties to farther south in the Gulf, so we understand that. I think it's been somewhat of an issue here, but also somewhat remote because, again, for us, we're like many Americans. We just want to know how it affects our oil. I think some of the pictures of the turtles dying and some of the other things this week have probably had a greater impact here than some of the other events from earlier.
That cap on this week, here's BP Chief Operating Officer Doug Suttles again with that very cautiously optimistic tone.
It's a great sight because all of us have been watching those horrible images for almost 3 months now, and it's the first time in that time period that we haven't seen that image. But I have to stress, we have to manage our expectations because depending on what the results are could depend on what happens next. It's possible if the pressures are low that we'll have to reinitiate the flow and capture it. And I want to tell you we're fully prepared to do that.
Jack Beattie, everybody's happy to see that video not gushing anymore from the Gulf floor. This story is not necessarily over, and the legacy, the impact of what's already been gushed into the Gulf could go on, we're told, for a long, long time.
It could indeed, and there are going to be political ramifications. The Democrats are, in the House at least, are talking about an amendment that would prevent BP from getting future contracts in the Gulf. very controversial. Whether it would survive in the Senate remains to be seen, but that's the kind of a punitive step, at least some are thinking of. I take comfort in this current moment from the standbys, the backups. There are now four ships, apparently, around the well that have the capacity to suck up 80,000 barrels a day, which is pretty much about what's coming out at full flow, if it should go back to that. My question is, why weren't the ships there before? And then, of course, the ultimate solution, which is the relief well, the lateral, you know, drilling for that is only 4 feet from this Macondo well. So that also is hopeful. That's the ultimate solution, to tap that relief well in and to fill up the Macondo well with mud and cement. And that it's just 4 feet away, I think, gives one some confidence that a more stable solution can be found soon.
That as the big seal here, because I guess the Jeff Mapes, I guess what they're worried about is with the cap on, if there's not enough pressure in that pipe, and the readings so far are ambiguous, are the news reports, if there's not enough pressure, it could mean that there are leaks elsewhere along the line. You'd thought that in all these 80-plus days, we would have found those as well. The country's emotions kind of on the line here, Jeff, as we get a cap and then maybe, who knows, gushing again and then waiting for this relief well. Hard to really say this is completely over.
Yeah, that's indeed the case. Boy, we're all sort of playing petroleum engineers now, aren't
yes,
we? We're
yes.
getting this lesson. I mean, one thing that we're sure learning a lot about this is all the difficulties of drilling in this deep water. I think we just sort of have a tendency to take for granted that, technology kind of as long ago solved problems like this, and we're sure learning it's not as simple as maybe we once thought.
Off your shore there in Oregon, you don't have drilling, as I understand.
No, we don't. And there's long been moratoriums on drilling out here. There have at various times been estimates of a lot of oil offshore, although we're not talking the kind of deposits there are in the Gulf. And it's interesting to me, you know, there will often be kind of folks starting to say, well, you know, we should explore drilling off the coast. In fact, in this, once kind of the recession took hold here and in the rest of the country, I noticed that political figures in the Northwest, particularly more conservative ones, started to say, well, you know, maybe we should open up the area to drilling, that, you know, it shouldn't be exempt. And then something like this happens and that kind of talk dies out. And we've been through several cycles of this, you know, really going all the way back to the infamous Santa Barbara oil spill. When was that? The late 60s, early
yep.
70s.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Exxon Valdez up in Alaska had a huge impact down here. So it almost seems like we go in cycles on these.
Let's bring our callers in right here. Omaha, Nebraska, Carlos. Carlos, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I would just like to say that it's pretty interesting how with the well being there,
mm-hmm.
that in case the seal actually does break again, that it's there for a relief action, because I remember hearing about how that because of the cap, that if it does prevent it, that it will actually may be able to have spots that will break in other places. And because if it does break, then there may be spots that will be worse and harder to get to. But what's cool is that the well is there so that it will be able to continue to provide just in case if it actually does break and prevent it from spilling so much more again.
Well, cool that there's a cap on, at least for now. I mean, it's both kind of appalling and interesting. Joe Manis, they're saying that there may be less pressure there now because so much oil has gushed out of this enormous well in those 80-plus days that they may not find the same pressure that was there in the first place. Do you think that all these weeks and weeks of agonizing over this will have had a real effect on people's attitudes toward oil and petroleum in your neck of the woods, Joe?
I think it possibly could. A few weeks ago, there was talk of a boycott of the BP gas stations, which there are a lot of in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
There's one just down the road from my house. But that sort of petered out. But yes, there has been a lot of discussion. You run into it in coffee houses or just on the street where people do wonder, you know, what this means as far as A, their oil prices, B, their, you know, gas prices, and what's going to happen down the road. I think it has caused people to really think about what's involved with getting that gas to the pump.
Mm-hmm. talk about a great big, flare getting our attention there in the Gulf. On Capitol Hill this week, finally, the big move on financial regulation, finally for some and too soon for others who don't like it. Here's President Obama talking more about this big overhaul, biggest since the Great Depression, he says will help the American people.
Wall Street reform will bring greater security to folks on Main Street, to families who are looking to buy their first home or send their kids to college, to taxpayers who shouldn't have to pay for somebody else's mistakes or irresponsibility, to small businesses, community banks, and credit unions who play by the rules, to shareholders and investors who want to see their companies grow and thrive.
Jack, Republicans very critical here. Only three came on board, but that was enough to put off a filibuster. It's through. The president will no doubt sign it very soon. And then there's all kinds of regulation to be written, but there will be a new law of the land. Does this, everybody's got a different view of this, but are we in any case in new terrain here, Jack?
Well, we certainly are. I think conceptually, I think the Times frames it right today that really a generation of naivete about markets is now over. The idea that the deal that Washington made with Wall Street, go and do whatever you want and keep paying taxes and we'll pay down we'll balance the budget, which is really what happened in the 90s. There was that great boom, huge tax taxes from Wall Street and on the rich and so on, helped to narrow the deficit, eliminate the deficit. But in return, of course, there was no regulation. Take this, for example. Yesterday, Maria Cantwell of Washington said that the derivatives market is $16 trillion. Up until yesterday or today, that was unregulated. Just think of that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news. Oil capped for now in the Gulf. Financial reform clears Congress. 1 million home foreclosures projected this year. Joined today by Joe Manis at the St. Louis Beacon in St. Louis and Jeff Mapes from Portland, Oregon, the senior political reporter for the Oregonian newspaper. Republicans were not happy about the financial reform passed by Congress yesterday, calling for its repeal already during debate on the Senate floor. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell warned the bill was just more big government.
This bill would impose 533 new regulations on individuals and small businesses, regulations that will inevitably lead to the kind of confusion and uncertainty that will make it even harder for struggling businesses to dig themselves out of the recession.
Joe in St. Louis, Jeff in Portland, help us understand how folks in your parts of the country are looking at this. Let me come first to you, Joe Manis. I mean, we had a giant meltdown on Wall Street. It has cost people a lot. Do you sense general relief to see new regulations put through? What about this Republican theme of confusion and uncertainty?
I think it's going to take a while for some of this to shake out. In Missouri, the economy is bad. Unemployment rate is pretty close to the national average. A lot of jobs have been lost. A lot of good paying jobs over the last, let's say, 10 years. A lot of the strong jobs in banking, auto, a lot of those have just disappeared and they're not coming back. And this is something that is just really on people's minds here in St. Louis and then through the rest of the state. Our legislature has been in special session for several weeks dealing with incentives for a Ford plant, trying to keep it in suburban Kansas City. And so that's really got people focused on how much of an impact all this is having on them. And people are very wary. I think they want to see the details on this. Missouri is the show me state, and I think they want to see more of exactly what's in the bill, just as they are about health care and a number of other issues. People are very concerned. Obama narrowly lost Missouri in 2008, and I'm not sure if he would do as well now.
Jeff Mapes, I mean, now the legislation, once the president signs it, it gets handed off to 10 or a dozen regulatory agencies who come in and actually write the detail of the regulation. There are times when, after a period of uncertainty, just to have something begin to be actually laid out can bring in that kind of sense of confidence or clarity about the economy that helps. Do you feel that with this passage? Do you feel that coming in Oregon, Jeff?
No, I have to say I don't. You know, I've been sitting here listening, and I very much agree with Joe about sort of the attitude of voters toward the economy and what they're thinking about jobs. But, and maybe I'm coming from this from a political reporter's perspective, but, you know, I think a lot of this financial regulation bill literally is going to be, or the public view of it is going to be very much shaped really by the political ad wars that we see in the fall elections. You know, we have, for example, a very heated Senate race developing in Washington State right across the river from mm-hmm. where I live. And, you know, it's going to be one of the premier Senate races in the country. Millions and millions of dollars spent on television advertising. And there is no doubt that this whole area of Wall Street, financial regulation, et cetera, is a hot button with voters. And clearly you're going to, you know, I have no doubt from talking to the Democrats that they're going to make this an issue in their advertising, you know, that greedy Wall Street drove us into this recession and we're taking the tough steps. Mm-hmm. To
doing something about it.
Yeah, make sure they behave. I'm sure the Republicans will counter with this argument that, you know, the Democrats are overregulating business, that this is going to hurt the economy. So it's kind of a weird thing, but in many ways, the public perception of this might be shaped by a bunch of ad consultants.
Ad consultants and, no doubt, at some level, an unemployment rate or increases in jobs, however it goes. Let's go to Sam in Malden, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah. Fascinating subject. I was just wondering what all the guests think about the new financial regulation. It seems to me that it's from my perspective, it's just a smashing failure. And for, I think, a very simple reason. You can't propose a solution until you know what the problem is. There was never any sort of investigation of this problem where people were subpoenaed, much like the PCORA Commission. And the issue was never explained to the public. And for this, I fault the media. And I think it essentially boils down to, until the media and people understand that the banking industry and the insurance industry is basically a parasitic industry when it starts gambling. And that's really what this all boils down to. These people are all gambling with other people's money. And what things like the Glass-Steagall Act did is it made that illegal. You cannot gamble with other people's money. And what happened is, you know, all the winnings get taken by greedy Wall Street, and whenever there's a loss, it gets socialized to everybody else.
But the wall came down on Glass-Steagall, and you say still not enough protection there, still not enough clarity. Jack, our caller is saying that after, you know, it may have been taken nearly 2 years to get this, but in all that time, there hasn't really been a deep dig into what went wrong. Back in the 30s, there was. Do you feel like the country's really clued in to what happened in this last couple of years, Jack?
Well, I think the caller is right that the inquiry is after the fact. I mean, there's been an inquiry going on, but its report won't be issued until, I think, sometime later this year. Meanwhile, the legislation has passed, so it looks like analytically they didn't proceed, you know, according to Hoyle, which is to diagnose the problem through the commission and then come up with a remedy. The politicians reply, we didn't have time for that. We have to act. There was nothing to protect the economy against another one of these implosions, and so we have to operate with the best information we had. I'm heartened by our friend Simon Johnson, the MIT professor, frequent guest on this program. Mm-hmm. He gives this a B, and he says, he does point out at MIT.
And he's a tough lowest, grader.
Yeah, he says that's the lowest possible grade at MIT, oh. But he gives it a B, and he says the reason is there's an amendment in here that would allow the Fed essentially to shut down any bank that it felt posed a potential grave risk to the system. Now, the key question there is allowed. Will regulators use the power they're given? Will there be regulatory capture, as there was with the Fed under Alan Greenspan, as there was with the New York Fed under Timothy Geithner? And speaking of Geithner, who will be the people who run these new regulatory bureaus? For example, the Consumer Protection Agency. Mm-hmm. Geithner, according to the Huffington Post this morning, does not want Elizabeth Warren, another familiar name on this program, to head that. She's the one who came up with the idea for it. As in Congress, she's led the inquiry into how the TARP is being used. He doesn't want her. Why? because she's been so hard on the Treasury with the lousy job they've done on home foreclosures. So it a lot is going to depend now on what happens with those regulatory agencies.
And who will have the steel, if it should come to it, to actually act on what may be permitted by the law. Let's go to Jeff in Milton, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering if this is a moment approaching, much like the moment where the Democrats lost Ted Kennedy's seat. It was kind of a wake-up call for President Obama, and it was almost like pulling a rabbit out of his hat. He got the health care legislation passed at the last minute. So what I'm thinking here is that in this moment of crisis, he will take the lead, and he will make the election in the fall a referendum on the Democrats versus the Republicans, basically making the message simple. We're not going back. We are going forward. I've passed this legislation. It's not perfect, but this is the way to go. What do you want, America?
Yeah, Jeff, you raise exactly the dynamic I think both parties are going to go with. Of course, they're going to have different songs to sing about it. That was very much in the news this week with a real dust-up between Democrats on Capitol Hill and the White House after the White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs came out on Meet the Press on Sunday and warned that Democrats may lose the House in the fall's midterm elections.
People are going to have a choice to make in the fall, but I think there's no doubt there are enough seats in play that could cause Republicans to gain control. There's no doubt about that.
Well, that did not go down very well on Capitol Hill. Political reported that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi fumed over those remarks. Everything was kind of patched up by Thursday, at least according to Pelosi here at a briefing.
We have a solid organization on mobilization, on message, on the money, the M's, on the management of these campaigns. We fully intend to win. The comment can be interpreted many ways. I think it was a Rorschach test. But from our standpoint, we're very pleased with what the White House has been doing and what they will continue to do.
Gibbs at the White House, Democrats could lose the House. Pelosi, we fully intend to win. Jack, what do you see here?
Well, both, you know, the historic average is 28 seats. And I see that Charlie Cook, the political prognosticator, says that Democrats are really vulnerable in 35 to 40 seats. They only have a 39-seat majority, so that could really, really hurt them. And then, really damaging for the president. The president wants badly to get Obama's surge voters from 2008 to vote, but the polls don't show that. What they show is the enthusiasm gap that the Republicans have had all along widening. 70% of McCain voters are, quote, highly interested in voting versus only 44% of Obama voters. The Democrats can't possibly maintain their majority if that enthusiasm gap continues. They are going to try to make it a referendum, but they're going to try to say, the Republicans are going to say, this is a referendum on Obama and the Democrats. The Democrats are going to say, no, this is a choice between us and the party of no, between tomorrow and yesterday. And they point to things. You know, they say, yes, 58% of people don't have much confidence in Obama, but 72% don't have much confidence in the Republicans. So I think we're going to hear the claims and counterclaims between choice and referendum from now to the fall.
Joe Manis in St. Louis, these poll numbers out for the president this week not looking so good. Only 43% of Americans now saying they approve of the job he's doing on the economy. That's his lowest on the economy front yet. I mean, if the Democrats are, as our caller says, going to try to make it a referendum, do you want to go forward or back? In your neck of the woods, how does that contest look?
Well, as I mentioned, Obama narrowly lost the state in 2008, and most of the polls that have been done since then indicate he wouldn't do as well now. Now, we, like some other states, we have one of the marquee U.S. Senate races this fall. We have two very competitive, well-known candidates battling out for a Senate seat now held by Christopher Kip Bond, who's a Republican. There's a lot of national interest in this seat. Mm-hmm. Obama's already been here a couple times. He was just here a week ago. But that said, most of the polls have shown it close, or the Republican, Roy Blunt, slightly ahead. Our congressional delegation is 5-4 Republican. Mm-hmm. Two of those four Democrats, though, which would traditionally have been in safe seats, are really under the gun from very competitive Republicans. So you could see that in Missouri, anyway, it is going to be an issue. There are really a lot of hot seats going on, a lot of hot contests this fall. And I have to say, as a political reporter watching all this, the Tea Party movement and others aspects have really energized the conservatives more than the progressives.
Let's get a call from Bennington, Vermont. And Jack, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm always frustrated to see how the presidents are used as scapegoats whenever these issues arise, whether it's the previous administration with George Bush or now with Obama. I just feel like it's so frustrating, especially with this financial reform and even the oil spill. I mean, it's amazing how quick people are to jump at the president as a scapegoat for all of these issues. They have to look at so many more aspects of our government than just our president. And I think that, especially with financial reform, I think people forget that I think the previous administration really let these big businesses kind of run rampant, whether it was the oil regulations and all of that. I think that it's amazing that people forget about the previous administrations and are so quick to jump on Obama.
Yeah, it's true. A lot of emotion, a lot of frustration gets focused on the White House, whoever is there. I guess that's part of the job description in a way. Jeff Mapes, looking at Obama, these poll numbers again, Obama's latest overall job approval rating, about 50%, which is down. It's as low as it's been for him. I guess on the other hand, that's about the same place Bill Clinton was in the summer of 94, and you know, that following midterm went pretty badly for the Democrats. On the other hand, I should say President Ronald Reagan was lower than that. He didn't do so well in the midterms as well. How do you think that the president is handling his sort of messaging leadership, Jeff, up against oil, up against finance and economic problems? Is he a locomotive for Democrats in your neck of the woods or the reverse?
I don't think it's so much a question of a locomotive for the Democrats. You know, the problem that he has so much is he's really losing those voters who don't have a strong partisan identification. You know, for example, in Oregon, we have about 25% of voters who are not registered as either Democrat, Republican. Really about a third of the electorate really doesn't have any partisan identification. And the polling out here is showing these are really the folks that are moving away from the Democratic column. Oregon has been a Democratic state now for many years, really for the most part. The Republicans have lost six gubernatorial elections in a row, but their candidate this year for governor is running even with the Democrat, maybe even a point or two ahead. And a big part of that is that he really has a lot of appeal to independent voters. And these are folks, I hate to say this, they're not listening to shows like this. But they know they're hurting, and you know the economy is difficult, and that's really what they're focused on.
The economy very difficult indeed. So here we are, Jack. It's just 4 months before the midterms, and the White House and Democrats in the Congress sort of squared off with one another here over, you know, it looks like the White House may be positioning itself so that if it takes losses, it doesn't look so bad. The Democrats on the Hill saying we put our necks out on the block for you, and we want some more backup.
Yes, and this week, actually at the end of last week, the president went to Nevada, spoke for Harry Reid, endorsed him, went highly, and then earlier in the week, Harry Reid said, "Well, the president isn't fighting hard enough." So there's just no gratitude anywhere. You know, these elections are going to be so close. Karl Rove, of all people, pointed out that in the 2006 elections, the 15 closest House races hinged on 27,000 votes out of 82 million cast. Think of that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Yankees owner George Steinbrenner, the boss, dies at 80. Tough guy. He built the baseball dynasty his way. Here he is in 1983 defending that way.
When Babe Ruth was a Yankee, they had plenty of turmoil. When Joe DiMaggio was on the team, they had turmoil. Not of those specific players, but great Yankee teams and great teams. Everything isn't smooth. No ship gets anywhere on a calm sea.
Teenage, plane-stealing, nation-hopping, barefoot bandit Colton Harris Moore was caught in the Bahamas.
He's finally not terrorizing our communities. Hopefully they put him in jail for a long time so that he isn't right back out. Hopefully they can keep him there.
And Bristol Palin and Levi Johnston announced their engagement to the world and to Sarah Palin on the cover of Us Weekly magazine. Here's David Letterman's take.
He'll be arriving at the church tied to Sarah Palin's pickup.
That's right.
We're looking at a week in the news. Oil capped for now in the Gulf. Financial reform clears Congress. 1 million home foreclosures projected this year. That's more than last year. Jeff Mapes is with us from the Oregonian, joins us from Portland, Oregon today. Joe Manis is here from the St. Louis Beacon. Jack Beatty's here. NAACP saying, this week had a resolution at their meeting just across the state from you there, Joe, in Kansas City, Missouri. Accused the Tea Party movement of harboring racist elements that are a threat to our democracy. Sarah Palin, speaking of the Palins, came right back with a Facebook post branding that resolution a regressive and diversionary tactic to change the subject. What do you make of it, Joe?
Well, this has been something that's been simmering for months. In fact, here in Missouri, there's been some accusations about some elements, not most of it, but some elements of the Tea Party for some time. In fact, the congressman from the Kansas City area, Emmanuel Cleaver, was the one who alleges that he was spit on in that very well-known video that's
months
gone
back.
Viral.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. So this has been something that in our state has been discussed for some time. So this isn't anything that's necessarily surprising. Obviously, a lot of people disagree with it, but there are some who say, look, if you look at a lot of the Tea Party gatherings, although most of people are not like that, you're always going to have a few extremists on both sides. And unfortunately, there are some people who want to promote some of this.
Tea Party pushing back this week. Here's the Reverend C.L. Bryant, Tea Party activist, saying that any apparent racism comes from the fringe.
There is no racist behavior from people who are associated with Tea Party. There are certain people on the fringe, as you know, that will infiltrate these types of things. Every sign that you have seen that is derogatory has been denounced already by organizers and leaders of this movement.
Well, I don't know about every sign or no behavior, but pretty tough pushback here. Tea Party Express leader Mark Williams was on CNN this week, Jack, describing the NAACP as, quote, a bunch of old fossils looking to make a buck off skin color.
Ooh.
Jack?
Yeah, and he went on to say, how can the NAACP call us, the Tea Party, racist when it, quote, has colored in its name? That's not a very effective debating point. Some months ago, we talked about it on the show, the New York Times polled Tea Party members or enthusiasts, I don't know how that found them, and it did show a marked difference between attitudes of the country at large on race and attitudes of the Tea Party members. And these were on things like, does President Obama favor minorities or does he govern for the whole of the country? Tea Party people in much greater numbers than the country as a whole felt that. Now, that didn't show racism. It did show views on race that were somewhat out of the mainstream.
Jeff Mapes in Oregon, what do you make of the debate?
In Oregon, very much this debate has sort of spilled into the whole issue of illegal immigration, which is a big issue here. Not perhaps to the degree it is in California or Arizona, mm-hmm. certainly, but you know, many people who are involved in the Tea Party, that's a big issue for them too. So you see some of those same battle lines being drawn there with. Also, some of the supporters of immigrants who've come to this country, you know, accusing them of racism in that way. So we're seeing some of those same things played out. I mean, I think what we're seeing in many of this case, really, though, is that the Tea Party, I mean, it really is, for the most part, a politically conservative movement. And so you're really seeing a lot of those same schisms that you've seen for several years, you know, the ideological schisms mm-hmm. that moves over into race, too.
Let's go to Keith in Evansville, Indiana. Keith, you're on the air.
Yes. You can't pick up the paper or listen to a news program without hearing about the Tea Party. And I'm curious about where their funding is coming from. how much money they're spending, what you all see as their agenda for how they will use those monies in the upcoming election period, and if there's been any investigative reporting about where that money's coming from.
Keith, thanks for your call. Jack, I mean, early on, there was talk about Dick Armey and others involved sort of in back rooms in getting funding together behind some of the Tea Party stuff. I don't know where that stands right now. Maybe you do, but clearly a lot of people have just climbed on this bus of their own volition. How do you think it plays out for Republicans in the fall, and what do you think about its support, Jack?
Well, I think you're right, Tom. I mean, at first it sounded much more like an AstroTurf movement with the top-down Dick Armey and some oil interest and so on putting money out. But it's really taken off. There's no question about that. And it's much more now bottom-up, it would seem. Lots of enthusiasm. And on the funding, they've had some issues there, issues of profiteering. Remember now, there were two different Tea Party groups. One, I think, was suing the other over the use of the name and over what looked to be the profiteering of one of these groups, ripping off, taking more money, siphoning off a lot of money to the people who are running the fundraising campaigns to their own pockets. So they've had some scandals there. But I think there's no question it has a momentum quite apart from the AstroTurf now. And on the fall, it just remains to be seen. I mean, look at Nevada. If anybody seemed like a dead duck, it was Harry Reid for one reason. His son is running for governor at the same time, just when Nevadans seemed tired of the name Reid. But now, according to today's paper, he's up 7 points over Sharon Angle, who's the Tea Party endorsed candidate for senator and whose positions have been characterized, if not caricatured, as extreme. So that's a case of perhaps, who knows what's going to happen, but Harry Reid looks better because he's running against a Tea Party endorsed candidate.
Tea Party itself trying to kind of keep things in line, but then it's not centralized. Mason City, Iowa this week, they took down that billboard that had Barack Obama up. This was in the 600 block of South Federal Ave in Mason City, had President Obama up on the big billboard alongside Adolf Hitler and Vladimir Lenin. I'm not sure what you call that, but it's out there, and now it's gone. Jarrett in Wilkesboro, South Carolina. Jarrett, you're on the air. Well, looks like we lost Jarrett there. Let's go to Dothan, Alabama, and Gary. Gary, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I wanted to say that the Palins being back in the forefront of the news and with the odds of Sarah Palin running for president, we all, of course, know she's not the sharpest tool in the shed. It bears out the truth in a movie called Idiocracy, if you've ever had a chance to see that, where the less intelligent of the world outbred the intelligent of the world and eventually took over. And she's living proof of this.
Well, I guess we hear exactly where you come from on Sarah Palin. And yet, Jeff Mapes, maybe not in Oregon, but in conservative circles, a lot of people still come to her. She's out there with a big video talking about angry grizzly mamas, and it's getting picked up like hotcakes.
Oh yeah, she's among conservatives, she's a tremendously popular figure. She was out here in Oregon a few months ago giving a speech before a Republican group, and same kind of thing you've seen around the country. Sold out. The local party made a bunch of money. I think Sarah Palin made a bunch of money off of it as well. So, and frankly, the more she sort of takes hits in the mainstream media and from the liberal side, it seems to only increase her brand.
How does Sarah play in your neck of the woods, Joe?
Sarah Palin is extremely popular among the conservative movement in Missouri. During the 2008 election, when she was in town or anywhere in Missouri, you could always count on huge crowds. I covered several of them, including one in Cape Girardeau, which is the home of Rush Limbaugh. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, she really attracts a lot of people who social conservatives, some fiscal conservatives, because they like her straight talk. And I can really see where she kind of galvanizes those people who feel, right or wrong, that the elitists are running things and don't care about the average person. And she taps into to some of that. And she is popular definitely with the Tea Party crowd in Missouri. And the Tea Party crowd, by the way, is pretty much very much a grassroots movement here. There are a few wealthy people who are just starting to put some money in here for some elections that are coming up. But it's pretty much been a bottom-up movement here. And she's definitely one of their key figures.
Rick in Iowa City. You're on the air, Rick.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Concerning the Tea Party, I hear an awful lot of talking points and a lot of anti-rhetoric and not too many solutions and what they would do. And I think if they look back a bit, there was the old saying that Newt Gingrich found out that it was a lot easier to run and win a revolution than it was to govern once the revolution was over. And so I was wondering if your guests had any comments on that, and I'll take it off the air. Thank you.
Rick, thanks very much. Jeff, I mean, yeah, it's harder to govern than it is to make the case against problems, I guess. That's true in any movement, but the Tea Party does have a high emotional angle.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the caller is absolutely right. You know, the interesting thing is we had two, you know, sort of wave elections nationally for Democrats in 2006, 2008, because they were unhappy with what they were seeing from the Republicans in their lives, you know, particularly in 2006. I think a lot of it was the war in Iraq. 2008, you know, of course, the economy had just collapsed. And, you know, if the Republicans have a great year this time, it will be, you know, because the economy is not turned around quickly enough. And you got to say, well, where are voters going to be in 2012? Or, you know, are they still going to? I mean, it's probably ridiculous to be getting out too far ahead or talking about that. But you get my point, is that people are just not seeing what they're wanting from the parties in control in recent years, and we could be in a period of switching back and forth.
Yeah, volatile, maybe like the markets these days.
Yeah.
Jack, you've been watching the debate going on over Afghanistan. Not an easy path there. And Richard Holbrooke speaking up this week in Washington, getting a little grilling from Congress. What'd you hear?
Well, he was greeted with skepticism from both Republicans and Democrats about the prospects of success. And he replied that we have to succeed because, as he said, this isn't Vietnam. Vietnam didn't matter to the United States. This does. Of course, at the time, Vietnam was said to matter by every president and by much of the Congress. You know, this week, I really think there was a minor breakthrough in Afghanistan. General Petraeus, after apparently Herculean persuasion, has talked President Karzai into arming militia around the country, village militia, a sort of Sons of Afghanistan program modeled on the Sons of Iraq program that Petraeus started there. And this is in a way, this is significant. In another way, it shows you just how desperate things are, that now one of the solutions is to give arms to villages to defend their village. And Karzai has long said, well, what about those arms somehow coagulating into warlord groups or being used against the regime? So we don't know. It is significant because McChrystal couldn't do this. He didn't have the authority. Petraeus is backed by the president, and Karzai knew it. So he was able to get that through.
But how do you know you're not just arming the Taliban? I mean,
well,
it seems like billions maybe have gone to the Taliban, let alone just guns that are on the street.
Absolutely, and that's just the issue. How much of this will be porous? How much of this will just spill over? One doesn't know. I think it's a mark of desperation, frankly. And it also shows the palsy of the government. The government can't protect these villages, so they're going to turn to the people and say, how about a vigilante group here to protect your own village?
Joe Manis, what's the stomach for Afghanistan, the Afghan war in St. Louis these days?
I think people are concerned. We've just had a couple soldiers in the state lose their lives over there.
Mm-hmm.
So it is increasingly capturing people's attention, as you know, as Iraq once did. Now it's the focus is on Afghanistan. I think people are concerned. At the same time, people are also, though, are concerned about national security, and the Republican emphasis for years has been that that we need to fight him over there so we're not fighting him over here. And I think that message still resonates, at least in Missouri, although people are concerned and wary about where this is going to go, especially at a time of increased deficits and the troubled economy and all those other issues in the backdrop. But yeah, people are definitely paying attention.
Jeff, fight him over there, not here. Does that fly in Oregon?
I mean, there's some of the same divisions here that Joe described in Missouri. One thing, though, is intriguing, and I do hear from some conservatives that they're questioning whether what we're doing in Afghanistan makes sense and, you know, whether we ought to move it. Almost sort of more of a libertarian Ron Paul kind of approach, if you will. And I think there is a strain of that among the conservative side. And, of course, on the liberal side, Democratic side, I mean, there's a lot of divisions there, too. You know, Obama is far from having the universal support of his party on this war policy.
We heard Ron Paul right here this week saying, maybe time to cut back, time to get out. Jack, if that comes, you're following this week. We've just got a few seconds, but Afghan women, who knows what their fate is if something gets negotiated with the Taliban?
Human Rights Watch is warning about that this week in a major report that they shouldn't be sacrificed for the government to make a deal with the Taliban. They have to be protected.
But shouldn't is a very different thing than won't. Big week. We're out of time. Let's hope that that cap holds in the Gulf of Mexico. Good news, if only it can last. Joe Manis with the St. Louis Beacon, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very, very much.
And Jeff Mapes at the Oregonian in Portland. Thanks, Jeff.
Sure, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Jack, have a good one. This is On Point.